Everybody safe? Is everybody okay? I'm exhausted. I haven't even started talking. that's amazing.
I think we're going to stop at one kid, maybe. That's the way to go here.
It's great to see you all. This is really fun in the midst of the craziness of this day, but great to see your faces. Turn with me to Exodus chapter 34. This is still a church, despite appearances this morning. So let's open God's word. No, that is being church. That is being church. It's beautiful. Exodus 34. Most of you know we're in the middle of this series on the attributes of God. We're looking at just what a great God we have. And each week we're looking at a different attribute of his. Last week we looked at the fact that God is so merciful and gracious and so long-suffering with us. And this week we're going to turn to an attribute that feels different than that. We're going to look at the fact that our God is a jealous God, right? God is jealous, and that initially probably strikes you as strange, but I want to try to explain that because God himself tells us that he's jealous. So what we're going to do is we're going to spend our time in the book of Hosea today, but I want to just touch down here in Exodus 34. This is where God mentions that he's jealous, and this is picking up right where we left off last week. For those of you that were here last week. So just remember the story. God rescued Israel from slavery in Egypt, brought them into the wilderness, and then at Mount Sinai, he made a covenant with them, and he gave them these commandments. And the first commandment was, you shall have no other gods before me. And the second one was, you shall make no idols. And what we saw last week is that the people are very quick to turn from those commandments. And Moses was up on the mountain for 40 days and the people got nervous. And so what they did is they went back to what they were used to in Egypt and they made an idol and they bowed down and worshiped this golden calf instead of God. And we saw how God responded. And ultimately God responded very graciously and he maintained faithfulness to them. And so in chapter 34, verse 10, what he does is he reinstitutes the covenant. Even though they've been unfaithful to him, he says, we're going to still be in this covenant together. So I'm in verse 10, chapter 34. Then the Lord said, I'm making a covenant with you, even after what's happened. Before all your people, I will do wonders never before done in any nation in all the world. The people you live among will see how awesome is the work that I, the Lord, will do for you. And then he says in verse 12, they're about to enter into the promised land. And he says this, be careful not to make a treaty with those who live in the land where you're going, or they will be a snare among you, because they worship other gods. Verse 13, break down their altars, smash their sacred stones, and cut down their Asherah poles. This is the way the other people worshiped. And here's the verse. Verse 14, do not worship any other god, for the Lord, whose name is jealous, is a jealous God. So God says, when you go into the sand, I don't want you to worship any of their gods, because I am a jealous God. So let's just start with, what does he mean when he says, I'm a jealous God? Most of us have a negative connotation when we think of the word jealousy, right? It's usually not a good thing to be jealous. And usually what we mean is jealousy is wanting something that is not appropriately ours to have, right? Maybe you've got a friend who's got a car that you'd really like, or a house that you'd really like, or a marriage, or a set of kids, or a set of gifts that you wish you had, and what you feel is jealousy. You wish you had that, and we use other words like envy, or you covet those things, and that is a bad kind of jealousy. But that's not the jealousy that God is talking about here. He's talking about a good jealousy, and how I would think of this is it's wanting something, zealously wanting something that is appropriately yours to want and to have. And in God's case, the thing that he wants is the hearts of his people. He says, I want your hearts. I want to be first place in your hearts. I don't want to share you with other gods. And it's appropriate for him to have that kind of jealousy. So when I think of jealousy, I think it's God's zeal, his intense passion that he would be first place in our hearts, that there wouldn't be other gods that get in between us, that there wouldn't be other things that pull us away from worshiping him alone. And it's very appropriate for him to be jealous in that sense. So that the obvious analogy, of course, is marriage, right? As a husband, it's very appropriate for me to be jealous for my wife in one sense. Now, there could be a bad jealousy where I'm a really insecure guy, right? And every time Carrie talks to any other guy, I'm getting really insecure and I'm getting jealous. That would be a bad thing. But if I see a guy approaching her who is actually flirting with her, actually trying to pull her affections away from me, it's really appropriate for me to say, that's not okay. I'm your husband. You're my wife. I am not good with that. That kind of affection belongs to me. I'm your husband. In fact, it'd be really weird if I didn't feel that, right? If I wasn't angry, if I wasn't concerned with that other guy or with her, if she started going after that other guy. Okay, it's a zeal for my wife's romantic affection that appropriately belongs to me as her husband. And that's the sense in which God is jealous for his people. He has this intense zeal for our hearts, that he would be first in our affections and in our hearts. And before I go on and we look at the story of Hosea, I just want to stop before we get into it and ask you, do you believe that about God? Like, you know, you hear that. But do you actually believe that the creator of the universe zealously desires your heart? That he says, I want to be first in your heart. I don't want to share you with other lovers. It matters to me that I am first in your place. I don't want to have any rivals with you. I want you just to kind of sit with that and go, is that the image of God I have or not? And as we walk through this, you can kind of sit with that. So we're going to look at, again, God's relationship with Israel. And what we're going to see is after in Exodus saying, when you go into the land, I want you to smash down their altars. I don't want you to worship other gods. We're going to find out that his people were, in fact, quick to worship other gods. And the other gods of the cultures were just so tempting to them. So with that, I want you to turn to the book of Hosea. And we're going to look at the first three chapters of Hosea today. And as I've been doing with all these attributes, rather than just try to describe what jealousy is, let's see it in action. We want to see God's attributes in action. So we'll look at the story of God's jealousy for his people Israel in Hosea, and then we'll ask, what would this look like for us today? So Hosea, it's right after Daniel, okay, which is right after Ezekiel. And then it gets really hard after that, so if you go the other way at least. Quick context, couple seconds here. Israel, as you know, they were down here in Mount Sinai. They eventually cross over, and this is the Promised Land, right? You've got the Sea of Galilee, the Dead Sea, and the Jordan River, Mediterranean Sea here. What happens is over the years, the people conquer the other peoples in this land, but then they have a civil war. Israel has its own civil war, and the nation is divided into two kingdoms. On the north, you have this northern kingdom, which is in that time called Israel, and then the south, you've got Judah, the kingdom of Judah, where Jerusalem is. Okay, this is about 750 BC-ish, okay? On the outside, during this time, things look pretty decent. Politically, it's a time of relative peace. Economically, it's a great time. It's a time of great economic prosperity. People have pretty nice lives. But if you were to look beneath the surface inside, you'd see that this was not a good time, especially for the northern nation of Israel. The people had wandered away from God's laws, and most importantly, they were worshiping other gods. The gods of the Canaanite religions around them, they had not abandoned the altars. They hadn't smashed them out. They were worshiping other gods. And so God, the one true God, sends Hosea into that situation to speak. And what we're going to see in Hosea is that basically his people are cheating on him with other gods. And God in this book reacts with all the passion, with all the anger, with all the jealousy that any self-respecting husband would have if he found out that his wife had been unfaithful to him. And I'm just going to warn you, this is very raw language, okay? This is like PG-13/R kind of literature, okay? You've got a God who is jealous, and he is reacting out of that jealousy to his bride who has proven unfaithful to him. And here's what God does. He chooses this guy, Hosea, as his chosen prophet. And first, he puts Hosea through a life experience that will parallel God's own experience with the nation of Israel. And then he has a message to teach the nation through Hosea's own life experience. So what I want to do is let's first look at Hosea's life experience that God puts him through, and then we'll look at how that parallels God's own experience with Israel. Okay, so we'll just look at these first three chapters today.
All right, verse 1. Let's look at Hosea's experience. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, son of Beeri, during the reigns of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of the northern or the southern kingdom of Judah, and during the reign of Jeroboam, son of Joash, king of Israel. Aren't you glad I didn't make you read this? One of you come up and read that today. Okay, so here it is. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, "Go, take to yourself an adulterous wife and children of unfaithfulness, because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery in departing from the Lord." Okay, one of the more shocking verses in Scripture. God calls a man and he says, "I want you to marry somebody who is going to prove unfaithful to you again and again. And I want you to have children with her, and I want you to raise a family with her." So verse 3, so he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim. So he marries this woman, and you know, there's two major problems with her. One is her name is Gomer, right? Second, she is going to prove unfaithful to him again. And we don't know. Some people suggest she was actually a prostitute. We don't know. But she is going to prove unfaithful to him again and again. And he marries this woman, knowing full well that this is going to happen. And so I want you to just picture what maybe this would have been like. Okay, Hosea lives in some town. We don't know exactly where. But he's, you know, a small town. And he decides to engage, you know, get engaged to this woman and marry her. So you've got Hosea, this very, you know, this man of God, this holy man, and he's engaged and then gets married to this woman that is of, you know, not great reputation. And just think about what the town, how the town would experience this marriage. I mean, we've probably all been to weddings where we don't feel great about the couple. You know, that, I mean, it's a bummer experience when that happens, but you're like, I just don't feel great about this marriage. And I wonder what the town felt as you've got this respectable, holy man of God marrying this person that everyone knows this is not a great person to marry. So he marries her, and then she starts having kids. So verse 3, he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Then the Lord said to Hosea, "Call him Jezreel, because I will soon punish the house of Jehu for the massacre at Jezreel, and I will put an end to the kingdom of Israel. In that day, I will break Israel's bow in the valley of Jezreel." Okay, without going into the details of that, he names his firstborn Jezreel, which was a reminder of this event that happened where one of the former kings of Israel massacred all these people and just went way overboard. So it's sort of this act of unfaithfulness. And so his firstborn is named after that act of unfaithfulness. Okay, so they have this couple, has this kid, and then they start living life together in wherever they live. And again, we don't know the details, but I assume over time, the rumors about this couple start spreading as people maybe, you know, they see Gomer starting to sneak out at night. And you know, she ends up at one of the local pubs or whatever. And you see her, you know, whatever they got back in the 7th century BC. And she is hanging out with guys that are passing through town. And it becomes pretty clear that she's at first maybe being discreet, but over time, increasingly less discreet. And people start seeing, oh my gosh, you've got this holy man and this woman. And we see what she's doing. And it's crazy. And yet Hosea continues to be faithful and to love her and to be a faithful husband. Well, in the meantime, they have two more kids. And I imagine at this point, no one really knows who the kids, you know, whose kids they are for sure. They probably don't know. But verse 6, Gomer conceives again and gave birth this time to a daughter. Then the Lord said to Hosea, "Call her Lo-Ruhamah," which means not loved. "For I will no longer show love to the house of Israel, that I should at all forgive them." Wow. Verse 8, after she had weaned Lo-Ruhamah, Gomer had another son. Then the Lord said, "Call him Lo-Ami," which means not my people. "For you are not my people, and I am not your God." Okay, so imagine this family, okay, in the town. This is. I mean, it's crazy. Hosea, this is my you know, unfaithful wife Gomer, my kids Jezreel, not loved and not my people. Okay, this is, but I mean, this is what's going on. Okay, and as the story goes on, turn to chapter 3. This is where the story of Hosea and Gomer ends. What's clear as you read this is as the story goes on, eventually Gomer leaves Hosea completely.
And she just leaves. And she probably gets passed around in the town, and we don't know exactly what happens. But either she ends up going off and marrying some other guy, or most likely, what most scholars think is she ends up selling, ultimately having to sell herself to somebody else as his concubine. Okay, and it'll make sense when I read this. So she's gone from his home, and she's you know, separated from him. Chapter 3, after this happens, the Lord said to me, "Go show your love to your wife again, though she is loved by another and is an adulteress. Love her as the Lord loves the Israelites, though they turn to other gods and love the sacred raisin cakes." So what he has to do is he actually has to buy her back. She belongs to somebody else. He has to purchase his own wife again. Look at verse 2. "So I bought her for 15 shekels of silver and about a homer and lethic of barley. Then I told her, 'You are to live with me now many days. You must not be a prostitute or be intimate with any other man, and I will live with you.'" And that's basically where the story of Hosea and Gomer ends in this book. So I just want you to think about this couple, this guy who had endured a marriage of complete one-sided affection, one-sided commitment, one-sided passion. And people have seen this, and it must have been humiliating. It must have been hard, and people must have been thinking, why'd you marry this person? I mean, why did you stay? And why are you taking her back? She doesn't deserve you. She's been unfaithful to you. Why would you ever do this? And with that, God says through Hosea to Israel, "You are Gomer, and I, Yahweh, am your husband, and I committed myself to you, and I have been faithful to you, and I have loved you, and you have cheated on me again and again and again and again, and I'm sick of it. I'm jealous." And that's the message of the book of Hosea. That the life of Hosea and Gomer perfectly parallels the relationship between Yahweh and his unfaithful people, Israel. So now what I want to do is, having seen their story, now let's look at the story again, this time through God's eyes, and see how that story parallels his story with Israel. So if you would go back to chapter 1, and we're going to look at chapter 1 and 2, and see this thing now from God's point of view. What we're going to see is God's jealousy produces two reactions in him. First, there's anger and this desire to judge, which would be a normal feeling. But then second, there's this mercy and this compassion, because it's his bride who he loves. And so you see, it's almost as if God is torn between these two emotions, because he feels so intensely for them, and yet they've been unfaithful to him. And so he wrestles with these two things. And we'll see, first, he'll communicate his anger and his judgment, but then he'll step back and communicate his mercy and his compassion and his desire for his bride. Okay, and we're going to see that happen both in chapter 1 and chapter 2. So let's go back to chapter 1 and look at what God is saying. You know, first he has Hosea marry her, and then he has the first one called Jezreel. Oh, sorry, verse 2, he says, "Marry her," and then he says, "Because the land is guilty of the vilest adultery and departing from the Lord. This is what you guys have done to me," God is saying. And then he calls the second one in verse 6, the Lord said to Hosea, "Call her Lo Ruhamah," which means not loved, "for I will no longer show love to the house of Israel." That's a hard thing to hear God say. And then how about verse 8? After she'd weaned that one, she had another one, and God said, "Call him not my people, for you're not my people, and I'm not your God." Okay, these are the words of a spouse who is feeling betrayed and just experiencing the emotion of that. "I don't love you anymore. You're not my wife. You're not my husband. You're not my people. I'm not your God." Okay, he's just expressing that jealous sense of betrayal. But then what he does in verse 10 is he steps back from that, and his mercy and his heart for his bride comes out again. Look at verse 10. Yet the Israelites will be like the sand on the seashore, which cannot be measured or counted. I won't destroy you. I'll multiply you. And the place where it was said to them, "You're not my people," they will be called sons of the living God. The people of Judah and the people of Israel will be reunited, and they will appoint one leader and will come up out of the land, for great will be the day of Jezreel. Say of your brothers, my people, and of your sisters, my loved one. So after expressing his anger, he says, yet one day I'm going to restore you and you will be my people and I will love you. Okay, make sense? Yeah? Okay. So I want us to see that pattern again in chapter 2. Same thing. First, he starts with his anger and his judgment, and then he steps back and talks about his mercy and his compassion for his bride. So the anger is in verses 2 through 13. I want to read the whole thing to you, okay? And again, this is very raw language. This is God speaking. I just want us to feel God's heart in this. Verse 2. Rebuke your mother. When he says mother, he's just referring to the Israelites, okay? Comparing them to a wife. Rebuke your mother, rebuke her. She is not my wife and I'm not her husband. Let her remove the adulterous look from her face and the unfaithfulness from between her breasts. Otherwise, I will strip her naked and make her as bare as on the day she was born. I will make her like a desert, turn her into a parched land and slay her with thirst. I will not show my love to her children because they are children of adultery. Their mother has been unfaithful and has conceived them in disgrace. She said, I will go after my lovers who give me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. Therefore, I will block her path with thorn bushes. I will wall her in so that she cannot find her way. She will chase after her lovers, but not catch them. She will look for them, but not find them. Then she'll say, I will go back to my husband as at first, for then I was better off than I am now. She has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain. I was the one who gave her the new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold, which they used for Baal. Therefore, I will take away my grain when it ripens, my new wine when it is ready. I will take back my wool and my linen intended to cover her nakedness. So now I will expose her lewdness before the eyes of her lovers. No one will take her out of my hands. I will stop all her celebrations, her yearly festivals, her new moons, her Sabbath days, all her appointed feasts. I will ruin her vines and her fig trees, which she said were her pay from her lovers. I will make them a thicket, and wild animals will devour them. I will punish her for the days she burned incense to the Baals. She decked herself with rings and jewelry and went after other lovers. But me she forgot, declares the Lord. Whew. Pretty intense. Jealousy coming out in our God for his people. Now, let me just make a couple points about what has just been said so we understand this a little bit more. Let's first find out, what is Israel doing that's making God so angry? Who are they going after? Okay, I want to show you this other lover that God's talking about. Verse 18 and verse 13, God talks about Baal. So let me introduce you to Baal. Okay, there he is. He is the Canaanite god of thunder. He's the storm god who brings the rain, and you can see why they were attracted to him. He's a very handsome fellow. He's got his little kilt and his sheath for his sword. And he's got a cool hat and a long beard. And he's this powerful god. He was the Canaanite god. And he was thought to be responsible for, he's the god of thunder and rain. So he's thought to be responsible for the rain and therefore for agriculture and the fruitfulness of the land and all that comes with rain. And the key issue was this. Israel had abandoned Yahweh and said, Yahweh's not the one that's providing these things for us. Baal is the one who provides the rain and provides for our crops and all this stuff. Let me just point it out to you. You'll see it in verse 5. It says this, their mother has been unfaithful and has conceived me in disgrace. She said this, I will go after my lovers who give me my food and my water, my wool and my linen, my oil and my drink. They're thinking Baal is the one who is providing these things. Verse 8, God says, she has not acknowledged that I was the one who gave her the grain, the new wine and oil, who lavished on her the silver and gold. And Baal worship was rampant at this time. Archaeologists, they've dug up so many of these little idols of Baal, and it's clear that Israel was just enamored with this god, Baal. And if you read the rest of Hosea, you'll see they did all sorts of things for Baal. They created these little images for him. They went up high on the hills and offered sacrifices to him. They went into the temples and slept with cult prostitutes to try to get him to do what they wanted. They even gashed themselves with stones to try to get him, to try to manipulate him to do what they wanted. And what almost makes it worse is that they hadn't completely abandoned Yahweh, God. Okay, God talks about here that they're still doing their Sabbaths, but the reality is they were two-timing. They were trying to worship God and also bring Baal into the picture as well. So there's our guy. So let me just make a few points about what God is saying he's going to do in response. He says, I'm going to judge you. I'm going to do something to you. And this the form that it's going to take is this. He says, fine, I'm going to bring on famine. I'm going to close the clouds, and I'm not going to bring the rain. Let me just point it out to you. Verse 3, he says, second half of verse 3, I will make her like a desert, turn her into a parched land, and slay her with thirst. Verse 9, I will take away my grain when it ripens and my new wine when it's ready. I'll take back my wool and my linen intended to cover her nakedness. Verse 12, I will ruin her vines and her fig trees, which she said were her pay from her lovers. I will make them a thicket and wild animals will devour them. So he's basically saying, you think Baal's the one providing for you? I'm going to show you that I am the one who provides, and here's how I'm going to do it. I'm going to take that stuff away. And then you'll find out who really provides the rain and who really provides for the fruitfulness of your crops and your grains and your wine and all that stuff. And his purpose in doing this is so that ultimately they would come back, Israel would come back to him. Look at verse 7, end of verse 7. After he does this, he says, then she'll say, Israel will say, I will go back to my first husband as at first, for then it was better off than it is now. His desire is to kind of put her through this so that she realizes, I never had it so good as when I was faithful to Yahweh. I want to come back to Yahweh because he's the provider. And God's saying, that's what I'm going to do. Is that the picture you have of God? When his people go after other gods and other things, that he gets jealous, appropriately so, for their hearts and says, I don't want to share you with other things. I want to be first and foremost in your heart. Well, that's not the end of the story, of course. After you get God's anger and his judgment, just as in chapter 1, you also get God's mercy and his grace and his compassion. And that's what we get in verses 14 through 23. So let me read those to you now. Beautiful picture of God's passion for his bride. Verse 14, therefore, I am now going to allure her, referring to Israel. I will lead her into the desert and speak tenderly to her. Okay? God is using this affectionate, almost seductive speech, saying, I'm gonna allure my bride, and I'm going to take her into the desert, away from the distractions, away from these other lovers. I'm going to take her back to the desert where we started. It's going to be like we're going to go back to our honeymoon phase, okay? I'm going to pull her away. This is husbands. This is the kind of language you use with your wives when you're at a dinner party and you're ready to go home and, you know, just be alone. You sort of this tender, I want to lure you away from all this. Let's get away, and let's go home and you know what, okay? That's the language that God is using. Does that still happen for any of you? Yeah. That's what he's saying. I want to lure her and lead her into the desert and speak tenderly to her. Verse 15, therefore I will give her back her vineyards and will make the valley of Achor a door of hope. There she will sing as in the days of her youth, as in the days she came up out of Egypt. It'll be like when we first got married. It'll be like a honeymoon phase again. Verse 16, in that day, declares the Lord, you will call me, this is God speaking, you will call me my husband. You will no longer just call me my master. I want that kind of intimate relationship with you of husband and wife. I will, verse 17, I will remove the names of the Baals from her lips. No longer will their names be invoked. In that day, I will make a covenant. This is what we saw last week. Again, I'm going to make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air and the creatures that move along the ground. I'm going to get rid of war. Bow and sword and battle I will abolish from the land so that all may lay down in safety. I will betroth you to me forever. I will betroth you in righteousness and justice, in love and compassion. I will betroth you in faithfulness, and you will acknowledge the Lord. And then he's going to say, I'm going to bring back the rain, basically. In that day, I will respond, declares the Lord. I will respond to the skies, and they will respond to the earth. And the earth will respond to the grain, the new wine and oil, and they will respond to Jezreel. I will plant her for myself in the land. I will show my love to the one I called not my loved one. I will say to those called not my people, you are my people. And they will say, you are my God. Awesome picture of God's passion and mercy and compassion for his bride. And that is the good news right there. And that's the good news that we saw last week, that the God commits himself to this people who are going to prove themselves prone to wander, unfaithful again and again, and yet he has this anger and this jealousy, but ultimately he has this passion to woo them back, to restore them, to establish that intimacy and that passion again. And he wants to relate to them as a husband with his bride, not just as a master with a servant. And that's basically the story of Hosea, this God whose name is jealous and is jealous for our hearts. He doesn't tolerate any other rivals, any other lovers. He says, I want to be first place in your hearts. Pretty compelling, pretty raw, pretty open and honest. So let me ask the question that I asked at the beginning. Do we believe this about God? Is this the way that God has portrayed himself here? Do you believe that that is who God is with you? Do I believe that that is who God is with me? That at the center of the entire universe is a God who is zealous for your heart, who wants a relationship with you and does not want to share your heart's ultimate affections with anybody else, and is jealous and zealous for your heart. Do you believe that? And I would just suggest, oftentimes we don't. I think when most of us think about our faith, we think about God, we think about Christianity, we think more in terms of just morality, right? We think there's a God out there, and he's moral, and I know that there's certain ways he wants me to live my life. He wants me to do the right thing in life. He's interested in my morality, and we think that's what my relationship with God is about. It's about thinking about what he wants me to do and do the right thing. And if we're honest, there's things that we really want in life. There's things that we really crave in life, if we would be honest. This is what really gets me excited. This is what has my heart. But I also know, as a Christian, that I need to do what's right. And so I'm going to try to do what's right, and hopefully there's some room left over so that I can get those things that I really want met somehow. That's why I think a lot of people live life. And the message of Hosea is this, is that at the heart of the universe is not some moralistic prude who is just interested in our good behavior. But at the heart of the universe, there is a passionate lover who is interested in our hearts. He says, I want not just your hearts, I want not just your behavior, I want your hearts. I want your passion, I want your devotion, I want your worship. And the fundamental battle of faith is not a battle for behavior. The fundamental battle is a battle for our hearts. The issue is, what at the core am I going to worship? What is going to get the first of my affection and my devotion? Is it going to be God, or is it going to be something else? That's at the heart. And behavior follows from that. I was thinking about the greatest commandment. What's the greatest commandment? It's not obey me. The greatest commandment is love me. It's essentially, it's love me with everything you've got. That is what I command. Love me with your heart, mind, soul, and strength. Everything you've got. And the first of the Ten Commandments is no other gods. I don't want any other gods getting in between us. So let me step back here and show you this picture again. Of our guy. And consider, what does this look like for us today? My suspicion is there's not a lot of you that are tempted to worship Baal. You can let me know afterwards if that is the case. That's not our temptation. But what are the gods? What are the idols? What are the things that threaten to take our hearts away from God? I was thinking this week of Paul's words in 2 Corinthians. He says, I'm afraid that just as the serpent deceived Eve, that your minds might be led astray from a pure and simple devotion to Christ. So what are those things that want to lead our minds and hearts astray from a pure and simple devotion to Christ? And let me give you a way to think about this. I think in terms of the three S's, okay, and I'll explain what I mean by this, as ways of getting, what are those things that might threaten to take our hearts away from God? Here are the three S's. Where am I tempted to find my ultimate security? What's the thing or the things that I look at in life and go, that's what makes me feel safe in life. That's what makes my future feel safe. What makes me feel like all is okay with the world. What are those things that where I find my security? Second S is, where am I tempted to find my ultimate significance? What makes me feel legitimate in this culture as a man or a woman? What gives me that sense of identity, ultimate identity? And then the final one is, where am I tempted to find my ultimate satisfaction? What just makes my heart stoked? That just, I crave that, I just love it. Okay? Where am I tempted to find my security, significance, and satisfaction? And it quickly becomes obvious that the idols of our culture can be harmful and immoral things, but of course they can also be really good things, right? Good things that God has given us, but that if they threaten to take first place in our lives, they actually threaten to pull us away from God. So these can be good things, gifts of God, but when we substitute them for the giver, it can be a problem. So let me just throw out a couple, okay? As I thought about this week, for me, the one that struck me this week is human approval. Okay, that is, I crave it. I've talked to you about this a lot, but I so much want the approval of man and woman. I want people to like me. I want people to think Dave's a good guy. Dave's a smart guy. Dave's a talented guy. And I crave that. It's like a drug that I need constantly to find security and significance. So human approval is a real common one. Certainly wealth, of course, is the big one in Orange County. I think if any of the New Testament writers stepped into 21st century Orange County, the big thing they would hammer on is wealth. This good gift of God, right? It's a great gift. And yet the hard part of wealth is it kind of goes after all three S's, right? Wealth, we can easily find our security in having enough. We find our significance in making enough. We find our satisfaction in what wealth can give us. So wealth, this great thing, always threatens to take our hearts away from a pure and simple devotion to Christ. Certainly addictions in our lives can be idols. Image, the desire to have this great image that we present to the world is a big one. And that comes through in different ways, whether it's physical beauty, whether it's status, whether it's working out. Certainly image, I think, can be an idol for us in this culture. Even our children, you know, and their kind of success in this world can become an idol if it takes too much of our hearts. This week at our staff study, we were talking about another one is just a particular image of the future that we may have. I just have some image of what my future needs to be like. And it might be whatever that might be for you. And when life isn't going that way, my security, my significance, my satisfaction is threatened. It could be an object. It could be a car. It could be a house. It could be a person. It could be a hobby. Any of these things that most of which are really good. But the danger is that they would take first place. The danger is that over time, these things begin to pull our hearts away from a pure and simple devotion to God. So that all along we might think we're worshiping God, but the reality is our hearts have been given over to all this other stuff. And if we're honest with ourselves and we look at what's left, what kind of passion and commitment and time and energy is left for God, there's like this much left. Because our hearts have already been given away to all this other stuff that a lot of it could be good. And one of the scary things, of course, is that this kind of idolatry can happen in the midst of lives that look very respectable and moral on the outside, right? And this week I was haunted again, those of you that are in our Friday morning men's study, haunted again by the story of the rich young ruler, right? This guy who, if he was in this community, would probably be an elder at our church and looked like a great moral guy, asking the right kinds of questions, knew his theology, and yet at the heart of his life was this deep idol. And when Jesus called it out and said, you need to sell your stuff. That's what you're relying on. You need to sell it and then come and follow me. When push comes to shove, we realize that this guy wasn't willing to part with that. He had another God besides Christ. And so the scary thing is this can happen in the midst of really, you know, moral and respectable lives. So just something for you to be thinking about. Let me turn that off.
So let me close with a twofold response that I think this attribute of God's jealousy calls us to. The first would be this, would be to acknowledge the idols in our lives, to sit with this and ask God to reveal, God, what are those things in my life? They might be good things, but what are those things that threaten to pull my heart away from a pure and simple devotion to you? And to acknowledge them and to confess them and say, this is it. God, I crave people's approval more than I crave your approval. I'm going to confess that. I find security in money more than I find security in your provision. I find my identity in being a mom more than being your kid or being a successful person, whatever it is. I find my identity in that more than just being your child. We confess it. We acknowledge it. We're honest with it. And then we actually take action to root those things out of the center of our lives. And obviously, we're all in different places, and so I have no idea what that action would be for each of us. But if you are convicted this morning, if there's something that God identifies in your heart that is an idol, and you feel like, I need to do something about this, I would just suggest that maybe the action you need to take is more significant and radical and severe than you would first think. Okay? Maybe it's something drastic. If you just idolize this car you have, maybe you actually need to just sell the car, okay? Or if you're watching, maybe TV, you watch 5 hours of TV a night, maybe you actually need to get rid of cable and get rid of the TV. Maybe you actually need to take that kind of action. And I just think we're so quick in the Christian culture to counsel each other out of drastic action. When someone's convicted and says, I feel like I really need to make a clean break, we're so quick to say, whoa, let's take it easy here. Let's be wise. Let's be balanced. Let's think about this. Okay? Aren't we quick to do that? And so maybe the action is actually radical and drastic, and that's what's required. The analogy here is God is a jealous husband. And he doesn't want us being unfaithful to him. And if you're in a marriage and your spouse has been unfaithful, the action required is not a baby step, right? It's not, you need to, bring down your interaction with that person from 5 times a week to 2 times a week. Or that's not the action, right? It's, you need to get, this needs to be out of your life. You need to change your phone number, change your email, get rid of the pictures. Maybe we need to up and move, whatever it takes. This is not a baby step thing. Radical action is required. And so for everybody, it's going to be different, but I just want to throw that out and suggest that maybe radical action is required, and far be it from me to counsel you away from radical action. How often do we err on that side? And maybe it's not. Maybe there's some little thing to be done. But maybe not. I just want to throw that out there. And again, it's going to be different for each one of us. But we've got a God who's jealous for our hearts. He wants to be first in our hearts. And so that's my first thought. And then just to wrap this up positively, and I want to end on this positive note, what would it mean in our lives to more passionately pursue God? Or maybe a better way of saying it, what would it mean to allow him to pursue us? Because we're the bride in this analogy. What would it mean to create space in my life that says, God, here I am, pursue me. I'm making myself available. I'm not going to go out on Friday nights and Saturday nights and Sunday nights with other people. I'm going to wait at home and wait for your call. What would it mean to create that kind of space in our lives? What would that mean for you? And it's going to be different for each of us. Certainly, maybe it's, I want to carve out time with you every day, 15 minutes every day. I don't think I have time. I actually do have time. I want to carve that out. I want to let you speak to me through your word. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's, I want to get involved with some people, get in a small group, people who are passionate to grow together in Christ. Maybe it's, what are those things in my life that help me connect with God? I want to do those things more. Maybe it's getting out in nature for me is that, or listening to Christian music, whatever it might be. I want to carve out time in my life for those things. Maybe it's, I'm going to go on a retreat. I'm going to take a weekend and go off and be with God and just be in his word and spend time studying. What would it look like to proactively live a life that's going to protect us so that we will have this pure and simple devotion to Christ? And I just want to end by saying the message of God's jealousy is actually incredibly good news, right? We have a God who wants us,
who wants to be with us, who cares about what's going on in our hearts and says, I want to be first and foremost in your hearts. I don't want anything getting in between us. So how can we pursue him and make him first and foremost, realizing that anything else is just going to be a cheap substitute to him? Let's pray. Father, your jealousy is a scary thing, but it also is an incredibly good thing. And I pray for those of us that don't believe it, that in our heart of hearts don't believe that you actually have a passion for us, in our heart of hearts don't feel interesting enough, compelling enough, lovable enough, that you would sincerely desire a relationship with us, not just because you're God and it's the right thing to do, but because you actually want us. You want our hearts. And so I pray that you would woo us this week even, that you would speak tenderly to us, remind us of your affection, your desire to have deep personal relationship with us. And then secondly, I pray that your Spirit would work in us to help reveal the idols, reveal what's pulling us away, and to comfort us in the midst of that, and then to help us know how do we let go of those things? And we can't let go of those things without your help. So help us to let go of the things that are getting in the way so that we could hold on to you. And as we do that, that maybe we would be something radical in our neighborhoods and something different, and that we'd have this passion for you that is contagious, that people see and that people want to respond to. Thank you that you are our great groom, and we are your bride. And we look forward to the day when we get to celebrate in total purity with you at the marriage supper of the Lamb. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.